Okay, let's get started. We are going to lose all of our board observers early today. They have a pressing other arrangement. So with that in mind, we're changing a little bit of the sequencing. We're going to do the Paper 6 series first. That's the variable payments. And then we'll do the Paper 5 because at least one board member has expressed an interest in Paper 6. So, Shweta?
Okay, thank you. So Paper 6 actually discusses two issues. One is on accounting for variable consideration for asset purchases, and the second one is on payments made by an operator to a grantor in a service concession arrangement. Both these issues are interlinked and were discussed previously by the Interpretations Committee. The discussions have been ongoing from 2011. The last discussion by the committee was in March 2013. The committee had reached consensus on several issues, including subsequent accounting for variable payments and on how to account for payments by an operator to a grantor. But the one sticking point was that the committee had not been able to agree on initial accounting for variable payments that were dependent on the purchase of future activities. So, having agreed on a number of items, the committee had decided to recommend to the ISB to make amendments to IS 16, IS 38, and IFRIC 12 to reflect its decision. But those amendments did not include any amendments for initial accounting for these variable payments. When the board looked at it in July 2013, they said that the initial accounting and subsequent accounting are related and should be addressed together. Because variable consideration was being discussed as part of the leases project and the conceptual framework, they decided to defer any further discussions on that issue until the lease redeliberations had been completed. So now that the lease redeliberations have been substantially completed, we figured this would be the right time to bring the issue back to the committee and to get your views on the appropriate way forward for this project. So at this moment, I'd just like to pause for my first question, which is to ask if anyone thinks that this is not the right time to be discussing this issue, given the lease redeliberations are substantially complete. I'll take that as a yes. Excellent. Okay, so Agenda Paper 6A discusses the accounting for variable payments for asset purchases, and I think we'll first discuss that issue. We have updated our outreach on both the issues as well, which is outlined in Paper 6A and 6B. The outreach has confirmed to us that the issue continues to be widespread. There is significant diversity in practice for both these issues. And when we talk about variable payments for asset purchases, one of the ways forward that we think the committee should consider is whether the principles developed in the leases project should be applied to the accounting for variable payments for asset purchases. The implications of using those principles are outlined in Paper 6A in paragraph 49 to 54. And just to summarize what those implications would be, for the initial accounting, we think that if the variable payments are dependent on an index or a rate, they would be included in the measurement of the liability, initial measurement of the liability. Other variable payments would be excluded. Subsequent adjustments to payments based on an index or a rate would be recorded against the cost of the asset. And subsequent adjustments to other variable payments in accordance with the lease principles would go against the profit or loss. But we think that for asset purchases, there are instances when those subsequent adjustments should result in recognition of an asset, and therefore we recommended layering on a capitalization test in those instances. So that basically outlines what the implication of the lease proposals would be if they were to be carried over to accounting for asset purchases. And in Paper 6, we have a number of questions related to this, which is questions 2A to D. A and B talk about the initial accounting, and C and D talk about subsequent accounting. And maybe at this time I'll open the floor to comments on questions 2A to D, and if you think the lease principle
those
is the appropriate way forward.
Follow paragraph 19.
Yes.
Is it useful? I see down in question 2D that the first time you touch on IFRIC 12, service concession agreement. Is it useful to raise the question broadly first?
Sure.
All asset purchases? Or to say, are these transactions in the context of a service concession agreement sufficiently different that we could leave everything else behind and just do that?
Just do a service concession, yeah.
So I guess that's the first question, is whether we want to pursue this broadly or just in the context of service concessions. Sue, did you want to weigh in there? Or? Okay. Views on that, about whether we continue to do this broadly? Bob?
As I was thinking of it, kind of in the opposite context of dealing with it in a simple asset purchase first, and then once we decide on that, then bring in, see if service concessions are different and addressing service concessions, because I think service concessions are a lot more complex than an asset purchase.
Okay. Tony?
I mean, Bob, I think this is an area in which there is diversity in practice. It's a widespread area, and I don't think it would be right to limit it to service concessions. I think we should think about the generic issue first, and then, okay, well, will we get to the same answer for service concessions?
All right, let's do that then.
Okay.
Now Sue wants to weigh in.
Was it useful to weigh in now or later?
Oh, you might as well do it now.
So, and I've warned the staff, so don't want to surprise them, but I agree that it's helpful to give people clarity on what they should be doing, so I'm not questioning that. And I'm not questioning timing. I think it's fine to do it, or maybe appropriate to do it post the end of the deliberations on the leasing project, but I guess I would flag as a board member major concerns with the path that the staff recommendations take us down for a variety of reasons. Firstly, I think that the leasing decision was made in a much broader context of a whole assessment of cost-benefit type considerations in the context of the bigger game of getting leases on the balance sheet, and that maybe we've made concessions there for the greater good that are not relevant considerations, and I'm not sure whether it's good practice to start using that as a starting position for ongoing discussions when it sort of was where we ended up as a result of assessing lots of other things. And also I think that leases are special because of the very close relationship between the right of use asset and the lease liability, and that might make me think about things differently. Secondly, I guess I question the whole notion that it should be sort of a standard thing that the value of an asset is linked to what's going on the funding of that asset and whether or not it's appropriate to be remeasuring the value of an asset. And I think there's going to be knock-ons. I think there's going to be knock-ons on things like hedge accounting. So, for example, you want to hedge inflation risk, and now we've built it into the asset value. What do we do there? I really don't like it, so I'm going to keep going. I also am concerned about users of financial statements, and I'm always a bit concerned about sort of assuming I know how they think. But my reservation on that front is that we now could end up with a situation where, depending on how you funded the asset, you could have a very different carrying amount. And we're going to have that in leases, sure, with right of use assets, but at least they're separately sort of identified, disclosed, et cetera, so you're sort of on notice that these are unusual, and so you know about it, and I think it's going to be trickier with assets more generally. And my last concern is a more practical one, which is how we would scope it and why we would choose a particular scope. So leases, again, I can identify those, and that's tricky enough, but I know what they are and what I'm dealing with. But if I'm now talking about all asset acquisitions, depending on how they're funded, I'm going to suddenly say, no, don't count for the liability over here, do something different. How are we going to scope that? Is it because the funding's come from the seller? Is it because it's done on the same day as the acquisition? Is it because it was done in contemplation of the acquisition? And if it's because of that, then my next question is, and why is that so different? So what's the difference between me managing to get the seller to agree to share some risk with me by selling me an asset and providing me with inflation-linked funding versus buying the asset and then separately going out and issuing an inflation-linked bond? In one case, would I think the asset value somehow is changing in a different way to the other? I'm dubious. So just flagging a number of reservations. And I guess if I step back from it all, I'm really concerned that the reason why this is probably going to be a very popular path, I've got no doubt, which is why I'm particularly wary starting down it if we've got any reservations, is because I'm a bit worried that there's an underlying desire for this accounting because it removes volatility, which isn't necessarily a good reason on a conceptual basis for making changes.
Recognizing all of those points, this is the direction that the board asked us to go.
Not all board members.
Not. I don't even remember if you were a board member back then, because it's been a while. But this is the direction we were pretty clearly instructed to go. So, Philippe.
Well, at the risk of not having a fun tonight, I would like to mitigate a little bit what Sue has said as a board member. I don't reject the fact it might be difficult. The scoping, there are some technical aspects, it will not be an easy project. But in principle, I think we are in a cost model. What is the cost of the asset? It's not about the value. If the value is below the cost, there will be an impairment. But we are in a cost model. We are trying to find out what is the cost of this asset. And to the extent that some adjustments are made to the cost, such as additional payments because of inflation, I don't see why it would not meet the cost definition. So I'm personally rather supportive of going that way. I know it's popular, but it's not only the reason why I'm supporting that. Conceptually, I think it's a good thing. I agree that we did not go to the fair value model for the leasing project. We went to a cost model with an assumption that the cost of the asset is equal to the amount you pay for it, the liability, except for the variable payments based on usage, which are future payments. In a way, we consider them as being executory, in a way, so not to be included at the initial measurement. So I think it's pretty consistent. I think it's consistent with the cost-based approach. And I don't have worries about the value, because I think the impairment is here to tell you when you paid too much.
Tony?
So I agree that this is something that we ought to pick up, because I think it's pervasive. I guess the question that I found myself asking after I'd read the paper was why most of the conclusions. So I don't intrinsically object to this as a path. And I don't intrinsically object to an answer that results in there being no volatility if that answer is conceptually justified. Where I struggled with it was the proposal that we do it this way because it was done that way in leasing. Well, leases carefully scopes itself out from everything else. So we are left with the other standards, and we have to work with what the other standards say. So if I'm buying a piece of PP&E, then I think I'm probably dealing with IS 16, IS 32. So why does the leasing answer work? If we didn't recognize a financial or a lease liability for variable payments in the lease standard because the board decided that that was too hard, then can we get to the same answer here or not? When I think about, so I just need to understand the why. If I think about the conceptual framework, it says no practical ability to avoid, which is a bit different to being able to say, well, I'm just not going to use this license. So how do I steer my way around that? When I capitalize some payments but not others, well, if I capitalize a milestone payment, I have no further I've got no more rights the day after I made the milestone payment to the rights I had before. I had an obligation, but my rights to that asset are exactly the same before and after. And so my challenge to the staff, and I'm perfectly happy to go ahead with it, don't intrinsically object to the answer yet, but my challenge is, can we justify it in the context of the conceptual framework and the standards we're working with, not by analogy to the strange animal, apologies, which is the leasing standard.
Tony, would you come to it? Would that lead you to a different answer on environmental changes in an environmental liability, which today we do add to the asset?
I think the important thing, he said, dodging the question carefully, because IFRIC 1 is what it is, is if the basis that led us to that conclusion in IFRIC 1 applies equally in these circumstances, then fine. But that was the gap that I had when I read the papers. It didn't say to me, here was the conceptual rationale for the IFRIC 1 solution, and it applies in the circumstances we're now looking at, because. So the answer, I guess the answer to the question is, it might, if the logic for IFRIC 1 also applies, and I can see it written down.
Okay. Sue, with your permission, I'm going to try and get the committee members in first. Carl?
Yes, I would like to echo Philip's comments. I do agree, and I do believe it's an acquisition of the cost acquisition of the asset, because you pay for it. And I support all the suggestions made by the staff. Actually, concessions under a non-executory contract approach or situation are suffering from the remeasurement of a liability, as will be the lease, the lease contracts in the near future, but without the remeasurement, the practical and good remeasurement solution that is coming from the new lease standard. And I don't see any relevant differentiation from payments from the operator to the grantor to get the right to operate the infrastructure and a lease of property for a long period.
Bob?
I agree with what Tony said and what Sue said. I do believe that the considerations around leases were that leases are special, and so they had special considerations. I'm a bit troubled when I think about this issue conceptually and traveling down a lease path, and I'll give you a different analogy. I sell Michael a piece of equipment that's worth $100, you pick the currency. And he's going to, in consideration for that piece of equipment, he's going to pay me based on a percentage of his revenue, so a variable payment. Now, if I understand correctly my accounting, and there is some amount of sales or revenue that he's going to have that I could say is highly probable of not being reversed, I think I recognize an asset for that in a counter to that revenue. So if I have an asset and the characterization of that asset is I'm going to receive cash from Michael, why doesn't Michael have a liability? I think also we're going to put a lot more pressure if we do this down the lease path on what is a business, because now if this is structured as a business, I get a fair value answer, and if I structure this and I claim this is not a business, it's an asset, I get a very different answer. So I'm a bit troubled by starting with the lease's analogy. I'd rather start with a more conceptual basis and then see where we go from there.
Martin?
I'm a little bit lost in a way, because we stopped the whole project. As we said, let's wait out for the outcome of the lease project, specifically with regard to variable payment, because that's the major aspect we need for the judgment how to proceed with that project. Now I understand. We waited for the wrong thing, because leasing is absolutely different. We can't make use out of these considerations which have been discussed with regard to leases. I heard several aspects with regard to the question of valuation of the asset. I heard some sounding saying, okay, these are kind of contingent considerations, and we have already something in IFRS 3 how to deal with contingent considerations, so why not applying this for an asset deal? I agree with Philippe, we are in a historical cost accounting model, thus if the asset itself is unchanged by the one who sold the asset to the acquirer, then I would assume that any potential future changes belong to the purchase price. And there is a very, very interesting numbering and the basis for conclusions with regard to IFRS 3, why they came out with the rule for contingent considerations not to adjust the asset or goodwill in that specific circumstances. And I just quoted, thus subsequent changes, it is number 357, thus for subsequent changes in value for post-combination events and circumstances should not affect the measurement of the consideration transferred or goodwill on the acquisition date. The board acknowledged that some changes in fair value might result from events and circumstances related in part to a pre-combination period, but that part of the change is usually indistinguishable from the part related to the post-combination period, and the board concluded that the benefits in those limited circumstances that might result from making such fine distinctions would not justify the cost that such a requirement would impose. Now I'm able to do such fine distinctions because I've only one related asset for which I have a specific payment. So I would conclude I can do this for an asset deal and it would be the right accounting. The other issue is how to deal with the liability side, whether I should account for the liability at fair value, so to say, right from the beginning onwards, and how I match this with the asset. But my overall fear is to come to the same accounting treatment as with regard to IFRS 3 for contingent consideration, which I believe does not really fit into the overall model.
Okay, there's a point in there that I want to come back to, but let's get some other views. Xiongsu?
I just want to echo to Sue's comments about applying the lease accounting principles to the property PP&E. I'm really worrying about it because, as I said in the email, lease accounting is a spatial accounting. It is restricted only to a very spatial situation, but PP&E is a very general accounting that can be applied to many other the assets like inventories, investment, the assets, and so forth and so on. So my concern is that if the lease accounting principle is the same as the other accounting principles like the IAS 16, or IFRS 9, I don't have to worry about it, but what I think is that they are not the same. So for example, in the agenda paper, what you described was that in the lease accounting, they recognize only the index-based or the rate-based liabilities as a liability or an asset, but that is different from IAS 16 or IFRS 9. IFRS 9 says liability, financial liability is the unavoidable obligation. And what I observe in the IAS 16 is that asset is the cash equivalent cost, which is a fair value. So that, those things are not the same as the lease accounting principle. So that if we apply the lease accounting principle to the pre-PP&E, we're going to come up with the different numbers, especially what I'm worrying is that, we're going to come up with a small number than what the IAS 16 or the IFRS 9 says. So different numbers means different, inconsistencies between accounting standards. So that is my major concern. And one more thing I want to say is that I'm not sure whether the lease accounting is really done. Is it really published and finalized? I'm not really sure about that. So why don't we wait until actually it's all done? And so that is my second comment.
John?
I happen to have been on the committee long enough to remember the last discussion we had on this variable payments issue and our inability to reach agreement on whether there was a liability or not in respect of variable payments. And I haven't changed my view from then, which is if I acquire an asset and I assume an obligation to pay cash, it's sort of irrelevant to me whether it's fixed or variable. I have a contractual obligation to pay cash, and that's what the liability is, and it's all about measurement, not about recognition. I'm not supportive of going down the leases path. I mean, I think for various reasons the leases has dealt with variable payments the way it has. I don't see anything particularly conceptual in that approach. And to then expand that and take it out and say we're going to apply that to the acquisitions of PP&E, intangibles, investments in subsidiaries, associates, right across the spectrum. I just don't see any basis for that. I certainly don't think that's an interpretations committee decision. So I'm not quite sure how we could proceed on the basis of taking that approach. So I would be in favour of recommendation 12B, which is that recommend that the IASB should consider a project on variable payments for asset purchases. And if they want to follow the leasing guidance and that treatment of variable payments, that's within their remit. And we deal with the question we were asked, which was how to deal with the payments made by an operator to a grantor in a service concession arrangement.
Andrew, did you want to come in?
Yes, please. I was actually broadly comfortable with proceeding on the basis of analogising to the leasing project. I agree with some others who have spoken that there's probably some more analysis to be done, really trying to kind of unpick those decisions in the leasing projects and the extent to which those are driven by cost-benefit concerns, and then the extent to which those cost-benefit concerns are equally applicable or not to the type of arrangements we are looking at here. If we've been waiting, John will know better than me, before my time, waiting a number of years for the outcome of the leasing deliberations, it's kind of a curious message to then say, actually, we've done leasing and ignore that, let's do something else entirely instead. But that's more perhaps a handling issue than a technical one. There is going to be a structuring opportunity if we go into a different place to leasing, even for intangible assets, where for some intangible assets you're going to have an accounting policy choice to apply the leasing guidance. So, you know, I accept the challenge about distinguishing between an asset purchase and a business. That is a well-known challenge where hopefully some clarification will be coming down the track in due course. So if we put that to one side, then there's going to be a major structuring opportunity if we have something that's going to give you a materially different answer between an asset purchase and a lease. And I thought the whole idea, people said leasing special. I thought the whole idea of putting leases on balance sheet is they're not so special. We're actually buying an asset. So there you go. I'm supporting the staff.
A couple of observations that come out of this. The first is the question, is leases done? Last I saw, it's at a pre-ballot stage. I haven't seen anything come around subsequent to the pre-ballot. So technically it's not done, but it would be very unusual on a topic this important for it to change.
It's on target to be published before the end of the year.
Yep. And we aren't going to finish this before the end of the year. So. So that answers that. The other point that I have heard coming up that hadn't occurred to me or hadn't crystallized for me, several people have talked about the question of linkage. So I could see it at the extreme case in which one currency unit changes in the liability translates to my ability to collect 1.1 currency units from customers. That's likely to be the service concession situation. That's a pretty clear linkage. The liability increases, but I've also enhanced probably an intangible asset. At the other extreme are some of the examples Sue raised. I buy an asset and then choose to finance it through an inflation-linked bond. Changes in the inflation don't enhance my ability to collect anything, so there's no linkage. Is that a path as we look at it? Tony said we need to look at what the concept is. Is that a path to pursue? Is it useful to look at linkages in that context? Sue?
Something I think Philippe said that was interesting is his view that it is part of the cost of the asset. And I wonder whether what we're grappling with here is whether something's truly just a cost of the financing versus really being part of the cost of the asset, which is sort of linkage but expressed in a different way. Because, and other people spoke more politely than I did, so I'll rephrase what I guess I should never say no, because you might convince me otherwise, but I guess my hesitation to start with was there was nothing in this paper that analysed and convinced me that actually it was part of the cost of the asset. Whereas I think in the leasing standard, and this sort of goes back to linkage a little bit, the whole way that we approach how to get at the value of the asset that we recognise is completely by reference to the liability. And that creates this very close linkage between the initial measurement and therefore, as a consequence, partly that's been linked to the subsequent measurement as well. And I think maybe to Philippe's point, there might be some cases where you do think about the way that the funding is happening is telling you something about the cost of the asset. In other cases, I think it might be more disconnected. So maybe it's something to do with the nature of the financing and the relationship between the two that needs to be analysed more for me to be convinced that this is a valid path. And that's probably what I really meant.
Yep. Philippe?
In relation to this point, I think IS 23 requires that you capitalise the cost of financing the asset when there is a specific borrowing for the cost. If I pay my supplier with installments, which may include inflation, I have to capitalise the cost of borrowing. I don't like it, but it's the way the standard is written. So we may exploit it as well.
Only until the asset's...
Yeah, only until the asset's constructed.
Not quite finished. Important feature.
Andrew, did you want to come back in?
Sandy?
Set my piece for now.
Sandy?
I guess, you know, the way that Sue just put things now was insightful to me, because as I read these, as reading it from the perspective of somebody who would use financial statements, I kept asking, and I don't have a great experience with service concessions, I kept asking myself, what is it that we're buying? And we're talking about these payments, and they're variable, but that's how they behave, but what are they for, right? And so I kept asking myself, we're sort of creating this, and I don't know what we're doing, and I get what we did for leases, but sort of glad to hear that everybody says they don't necessarily agree with all the conclusions, because, you know, we didn't agree with the spot rate on the index. And to Bob's point, as I look at these, I say, well, why shouldn't I recognize some of them? Because they're variable, but are they probable, right? And so what's the certainty? Just because they're variable doesn't mean they're uncertain. Those are different terms. And as somebody who would be using the financial statements, I kept saying to myself, what am I paying for? What are these payments for? Are they probable? Whether I put them on the income or on the balance sheet or not, I want to know they're coming, right? Or I want some ability to, as users of the financial statements, they would want to know how much are they, what are they variable upon, and would I capitalize them even if they're not on the financial statements because they're leverage of some sort. And so I guess I struggle. I get that we put it aside for the determination of leases, and I do think it's sort of interesting that now we're saying, oh, well, you know, that was
forget about that.
That was also special, and you're like, yeah, special in a special way. I guess I still struggle with, when I put them on, what does all of this tell me? You know, I don't know what the asset represents, and I don't know that I have all the payments, so what do I do with this except give me some disclosure, and I know everybody's going to roll their eyes when I say that, about what in fact this is so that I can make economic sense of it. So I guess I don't know where I'm coming out on it, because it's like I'm dealing with these payments, but I don't know all that I'm buying. So it's hard for me to decide what I'm getting to.
In fairness to the staff, I find myself compelled to remind everybody that the staff is doing what it was told to do.
No.
And it's okay for you all to say, no, that turned out to be a bad idea, but the staff did do what it was told to do. So Martin?
I heard your idea about probably consider what is the link between the liability and the asset, and I guess this is a way one could go forward. I only want to comment on Sue's argument, because she always used the term financing, and I agree that if you probably finance an asset, that
you might come to another conclusion or so, as if you are in a, say, risk-sharing agreement. Because you might negotiate a different price for an asset. Either you pay a certain amount fully paid up, or you do a risk sharing depending on external events, depending on, for example, a gold mine. Yeah, purchaser and seller have no idea how much gold is in that mine. So they agree, okay, you pay 100 million right now, and if you have a certain limit of gold you find in, you may an additional you adjust your purchase price. That might be something different than just, say, paying for an asset which value is, easily findable at the market, and it's just then a financing arrangement. And then probably coming from these two angles, one should consider the economic background of the situations. Because, I mean, I heard service concessions, I heard milestone payments, and so on. We have a very huge variety of adjustments which are not similar.
John, then Carl.
I mean, I think if we are going to proceed along the lines of considering the leases, we also are bound to consider the conceptual framework and the meaning of practical ability to avoid. Because the Interpretations Committee is bound to use the conceptual framework as well in its deliberations. So, I mean, I know it's not yet finalized, it's still ED, but the thinking in relation to liability recognition on practical ability to avoid, to me, has implications for whether some of these variable payments would meet the recognition criteria for liability.
Point taken. Carl?
Trying to answer Sandra's question, the payments from the operator to the grantor are related to under the intangible asset model, are related to the right to charge the users of the infrastructure. And generally, it arises under a public option, and to the extent normally there are strong competition, it represents the fair value of this right to charge the users. All kinds of payments, fixed or variable.
Tony?
I just wonder if the conversation we're having is pulling in a whole series of different examples and different situations. I just think it demonstrates that analogy to leases isn't answering the question necessarily. It needs a theoretical underpinning. And I say I'm content to go ahead. I understand John's point about it maybe being too big. I'd be very content to go ahead. But I think to an extent we're spinning our wheels a little bit, because we haven't seen the conceptual basis for the argument. So as an illustration, Martin said, well, if I buy the mine, I don't know how much ore is in it, well, isn't there an element of sharing the risk? Well, yes, that might be one argument. The other argument is the one that Bob made, is the guy that sold the mine, subject to the constraint in IFRS 15, would have an asset. And so I just think at the moment we don't quite have a conceptual underpinning for the debate that we're trying to have beyond let's analogize to leases. And I wonder if the next step is to explain in the context of the standards we're working with how we get to where we get to.
Charlotte, and then I'm going to propose something here.
I'm not opposed to service concessions at all, other than being involved, but I'm struggling with the conceptual basis. For me, the simpler answer, which seems to be conceptually where most people have been along, is you fair value the consideration you've got, taking into account its variability, expected flows, and that is the basis for your cost of your asset. What you then do for the liability depends on the nature of the liability, the variability, and that will give Sandra all the information she needs, that they're making sure they've properly accrued for it, properly measured it, and you know what's coming. I don't necessarily see the need for keeping moving the asset unless you're fair valuing it. And then some of the arguments for the leases almost seem to say, I'm not fair valuing it property, I'm going to put the index in fixed because I can't do it. And it's a sort of, this is sort of halfway house between just leaving it and fair value it. And the only thing I would say is this seems to be, maybe service concessions are a special enough beast that you could link them to leases and say, like leases, they deserve special treatment. And so then I'd go for that rather than widening it out to all asset purchases and intangible purchases.
Yeah, I think, and you've hit on part of why I raised the question of whether we ought to start with service concessions. Because I do believe, as Carl has said, that if a one unit increase in the liability is linked to my ability to now collect 110 from the intangible asset, then just recognizing the liability and charging expense leaves an unrecognized piece of the asset. So in that circumstance, which may or may not be analogous to leases, you could say there is, the asset has been enhanced as a consequence of what happened to the liability.
The right to charge increased.
Right. That probably doesn't exist if I buy a drill press and link it to inflation, because the ability of the drill press to punch holes is the same whether before or after. I think the instruction to the staff here on paper 6 is you've told us what the implications of following the lease model would be. You did a dandy job of that. Now what you need to tell us is why we should care and what the conceptual argument or the conceptual limits of applying that model are. I think that's the next step for the committee on paper 6.
Yep.
Is that acceptable to everybody? It sound like a plan? So you've told us the what, now you need to tell us the why. Okay? Where does that leave us with 6A, B, and C?
So 6A is on variable payment for asset purchases, which I think we've just covered.
Okay.
And the only thing I would like to say in there as well is we will bring back the whys to the committee, but I would like to point out that in the previous discussions, all these links to the standards on IAS 16, IAS 32, all the cost and financial liability were already discussed. And despite those discussions, the consensus could not be reached, and that's why the approach.
You did what you were asked to.
Yeah. No, that's fine. On 6B, moving on to service concession arrangements, the paper discusses the previous decision that the committee had reached, and we've outlined those in the flow chart on page 4. What the committee had previously said was first you should look at the substance of the payment, and if you are getting a right to a distinct good or service, or in the second case, if you are getting a right to use of a tangible asset, then you account for those separately in accordance with the relevant IFRS. If it's a lease, use IAS 17. If none of those two apply and the consideration, the payment that you're making is part of the service concession arrangement, the first thing you need to look at is whether you have a financial asset model or you have an intangible asset model or a hybrid model that you're applying under IFRS 12. And to the extent you have a financial asset model, the committee had noted that in that case, your customer is really the grantor, and it's no different than having a payment arrangement with a customer, and the principles of the revenue standard should apply in that case. At the time of the previous discussions, IAS 18 was in effect. Now we've just updated for the implications of IFRS 15, and we don't think that changes any of the decision that the committee had made previously. When you have the intangible asset model, the committee had noted that in that case, the payment really represents a payment in order to acquire an intangible asset, which is the right to charge customers. So and that's how the issue got linked to the first issue on variable payments for asset purchases. And when you have a hybrid model, they just came up with a test to see what that payment really related to and whether it was part of the consideration with the customer or if it was part of the payment for the intangible asset. So in terms of that, we would like to ask the committee if they think that that flowchart and those decisions that they made previously still applies, or if they think any of these decisions need to be revisited.
Carl?
Yeah, I
fully agree with the whole analysis. I just would like to suggest to retain to release an opinion about the Appendix A, the draft amendment suggested, because of the whole discussion we need to perform beforehand.
Okay. Tony?
I think the analysis, I think the committee got to the right place before in terms of the concepts behind payments by an operator to a grantor. I do think that we need to be careful with what we said, if you wanted to say anything, before we landed the variable payments issue. Because, for example, if there is a variable payment in an intangible asset model, and that variable payment is linked to, let's say, usage, I wouldn't want those payments, and we don't book a liability, then you shouldn't be adding the payments to the asset. They're an expense. So so the analysis is right, but I do think it is predicated on there being an answer.
Let me make sure I understand.
To the variable payments.
What you said, if we don't book a liability.
Right. So we've been debating whether if at the inception of the concession, the operator has an obligation to make variable payments to the grantor. Do you book a liability or don't you?
And
if you book a liability, then I agree, book the liability, it would be debit intangible asset, because you're in the intangible asset model. If we conclude you don't book the liability, then I'm not sure we want to say you would add the payment you make every year to the cost of the asset.
No, okay. If at that point you said it's an executory contract, and so yeah, okay. I didn't.
Yeah. Pardon the expression. Yes, I agree with the analysis, but it is predicated on nailing the first issue.
Yeah. Reinhardt?
I agree with the staff's analysis, and I think that there's likely a stronger link between using the principles and the leasing standard to service concessions than perhaps for the broader subject, simply because, in my mind, conceptually, having a right to use an asset or a right of use, it's interlinked, and so I can see some similarity of the principles. I think the whole broader issue in terms of variable payments, as we talked about, touches on fundamental issues as to what is cost and how do you measure cost. What is a liability? To what extent should you should the liability you measure be affected by your own performance versus other factors? And so those are very fundamental issues that we need to think through. But as I say, having said that, I think the analysis for service concessions that the staff has, I think, to me makes sense.
Okay, let's do John and Andrew, and then we'll circle around again.
Yeah, I think where we got to for service concessions is acceptable. I mean, I think to some extent you can see a rationale for it, and it quarantines the issue within the confines of IFRIC 12 rather than applying it to all asset and intangible asset, other asset purchases right across the spectrum. So I would support where the staff has got to.
Andrew?
I also support where the staff has got to, although I'd be I'm comfortable with getting to a different conclusion for an intangible asset in the scope of IFRIC 12 than for an IAS 38 intangible assets. I would prefer to look at the whole thing as a package. And a couple of slightly more detailed comments. There's some suggested language here on when the arrangement might contain a lease over an asset the operator controls, which seems to already be covered by a different paragraph, AG8, but using different words. So I just need to get in this loop, just sort out that. There's also an example in appendix or in paper 6C where the operator deducts an amount of one currency unit per user and remits that to the grantor. I thought you'd at least need to analyse whether that's collected as agent.
Fair point.
So I didn't quite agree with that, didn't necessarily agree with the double entries proposed there.
Carl, you have a passing interest in this one, I guess.
Thanks. Just to flag a practical concern, when we are talking about concessions, we are talking about 20 years, 30 years, 50 years old. I had one in Denver, U.S., 99 years old. My question is, how meaningful would be to recognize variable payments based on revenues? forecasting 99 years old would be a liability and asset this size with probably no meaningful information for users. Just reflect this practical concern.
Having grown up in Denver, is that the highway or the airport?
Northwest Parkway.
Yeah, the highway.
Martin?
I have one issue. I mean, with the decision tree, I'm fine. I start with the scoping question. What is in scope of service concession arrangement? So the overall question is a service sufficient? A public service? Is the providing of a public service sufficient? Because if you read through the standard and the background, you might get the impression that you have to set up, build up an infrastructure first, or you have to upgrade something or some additional task. So the overall question for the scoping, I guess, is a service sufficient? I found within the new paragraph 27B in A, the wording operation and construction services, if any. That would lead me to the conclusion there is no additional thing necessary instead of public service. So if I provide a public service, for example, I run a train on a track which I do not own, the train I do not own, I own nothing, I only run it, that is a service concession arrangement, all other facts fulfilled. I guess that is an important question with regard to regulation and what's in and what's out. We will probably see a potential, again, an item request with that issue. If we could talk already about this issue today, what's the overall idea? I mean, if all agree service is sufficient, then we are fine and we have more or less answered that question already today. And the second issue is if I have a grantor and an operator and I have an exchange of payments, the question is always, well, is the operator acting as an agent, and that would then have implications on netting of certain considerations. And I also miss this kind of discussion.
I think Michael and I are both looking at IFRS 12 because we don't remember what the scope says. So.
Yeah. Martin, your first point, I think, or I want to clarify, is it to confirm that IFRIC 12 applies to simply the operation of a service concession, even if you've not been involved in any construction or upgrade services? And certainly that is
maintenance and so on. Correct. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So yeah. That I think is paragraph 7B. Sorry, 7A. No, 7B. 7B of IFRIC 12 is that the operator, the operator has access to the infrastructure without the operator having constructed or upgraded that infrastructure. And that's why the words, if any, were proposed to be included in 27BA, because the if any applies only to the construction services. It doesn't apply to the operation.
Therefore, as I say, this helps, this if any, and that's very important, because if you go through background and read paragraph 2 and so on, you might generate the idea that you have to provide something in addition, specific maintenance or whatever, so that a service is sufficient for service concessions. That helps, and the other issue then probably we might discuss next one or whatever.
Philippe, did you want to come in, or did you change your mind?
Financial asset model. It's very important that we are in a financial asset model. The operator recognizes immediately the consideration to be received from the grantor as a financial asset. Then it is an adjustment to this asset, even if there is no construction. It's just a one-shot payment for the operations. So it's fine. I have the question, but it's okay.
Okay, I think my sense is that the general view is that you're on the right track on the concessions piece.
Correct.
So I think a first step would be to bring a paper back for the variable payments for asset purchases with the rationale of why, and once that issue is settled, then we bring everything together as a package with the effect 12. And
I wonder if I might propose a slightly different tack. Several people said that characterized leases as a special case. It seems to me that others said, and by the way, concessions in the intangible asset model are maybe more similar to leases than they are to buying a license on a patent or something like that. So in developing the why paper, I think it might be useful rather than waiting on concessions to bring them in as a special case. Is that acceptable to everybody? Everybody buy that? We may decide they're not a special case. I think don't think we should presume that, but I heard some rumblings. Okay. Does the staff have sufficient guidance?
Yes.
Okay.